From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In the battle for ratings, it used to be there was a cycle for morning TV shows, at least the major ones. One program is perceived as new and fresh, and then it crowds out the leader, which is perceived as old and stale. And this is pretty much how it went for years, but these days, the media reporter Brian Stelter says the rules of morning TV are changing. By last January, there were 12 different morning shows, all vying for that coveted demographic. Stelter has written a book that explores the mortal combat of morning television. He explains the history, the trends, the gossip and egos, of course, as well, but also the stakes, which amount to hundreds of millions of dollars. At the heart of the book may be this question: just what is it people want to watch in the morning? His book is called Top of the Morning. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Let's be honest, part of the reason people have been talking about Brian Stelter's new book, Top of the Morning, is for the dramatic inside stories about the battle for ratings in morning television. The latest, of course, is NBC's clumsy handling of Ann Curry's departure from The Today Show, which Stelter methodically works through in the book. But along the way, he's also explaining just how morning TV works, or has worked. The history of the form, the massive stakes. I should just mention here that the Today Show made nearly $500 million in advertising revenue in 2011. We'll get to that as we go. But the other part of the book is how it documents the way American taste has evolved, or anyway, the way network executives have read what the audience wants. It's one of the crucial questions in the book. What do audiences want in the morning? Is it pop culture and recipes? Is it breaking news and political coverage? And just how much of their loyalty to a particular program is determined by content, and how much of it is just the ineffable factor of chemistry between the two co-hosts? Today in the program, Brian Stelter is joining us to talk about his book. As I said, it's called Top of the Morning, Inside the Cutthroat World of Morning TV. You can join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Brian Stelter is a media reporter at The New York Times. He covers television and digital media. Top of the Morning is his first book. He's joining us today from a studio at the offices of The New York Times. And Brian Stelter, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I noticed in the dedication page of your book, you thanked your parents, and you mentioned that, as you put it, Mom watched Good Morning America, you watched Today. So you've been paying attention to this, these battles, I guess, these shows for a long time, I suppose.
I have, and I come at it first and foremost as a viewer, the way that hopefully all the readers of the book do as well, that we think we know these shows so well because we watch them every day. We think we know the anchors so well because we see them all the time. It creates a sense of intimacy that may not be entirely accurate, but is very powerful.
What are you making of the reaction to your book, at least so far? I mean, again, as I mentioned, a lot of the attention, of course, is in particular the story of Ann Curry's troubles with the network and with the show. I mean, there's a lot of attention to that. But I guess we should say, and we'll talk about this as we go, but, you know, it's more than that. The book is more than just kind of a gossipy story about poor Ann Curry, right?
Thank you for saying that, because I feel that the Ann Curry material is, in some ways, the least interesting part. Mm. I view this book as being two books, one about the Today Show and its struggles recently, and one book about Good Morning America and how that show finally figured out a way to beat the Today Show. Yeah. They, because of this rivalry, they work together really well, but they are two separate stories in some ways.
What was it that what about that interested you? What did you think that revealed? Was it just that it was revealing something about these two entities or television in general? I mentioned, because there is this conversation, which we'll work through too, what it is audiences want. I mean, what is it broadly that you wanted to get at, when you started the book?
I was very interested in the content differences between the shows and in the ways the shows have figured out what viewers want and what viewers don't want. In some ways, the shows are becoming more pure. And what I mean by that is they're focusing more intensely on a certain demographic of viewers and on what those viewers want. Good Morning America, every morning at 7:30 a.m. has a crime segment, usually some sort of murder trial that's underway somewhere in the country. One of the anchors said to me, Without that segment, viewers reject the show. They turn it off, even if the anchors don't really feel like doing that segment that morning. So the shows have gotten very effective at knowing what viewers want and don't want in ways that might sometimes make me uncomfortable, but in ways that I think are very revealing about the state of media in 2013. Mm.
Let's talk about the stakes, because this is kind of the context for the whole conversation. As I mentioned there in the introduction, I mean, we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars. The Today Show and Good Morning America, seen as the pinnacle of television. So in some ways, at least in this context, the stakes couldn't be more high.
And getting higher. And I'll say what I mean. It is about $1 billion in ad revenue that's split up between NBC, ABC, and CBS in the mornings. NBC gets most of that. They get about $500 million. The ABC, though, is trying to claw some of that away. And now that they're winning in the ratings, they're able to do that. And I say the stakes are getting higher because as media continues to fragment into smaller and smaller pieces, as there are more and more competitors trying to get people's attention in the morning, the attempts to hold on to the audience these shows have become more and more desperate.
I wanted to you spend some time talking about kind of the history of these two particular programs, and I want to kind of talk about the differences in the histories. Let's talk about the original recipe, as you put it, for the Today Show. It was a show that premiered first in 1952. Dave Garroway is the first host, and when he comes on the air in 1952, he promises a new kind of television. Explain what he's getting at. What's the context of the time in 1952?
Television was just being introduced as a medium across the United States. People were buying their first television sets. They weren't, frankly, very sure what to do with them. People weren't accustomed to turning the television on in the morning. It was typically a device turned on in the evening, if ever, as entertainment during dinner and after the dinner hours. It was something that didn't have norms and standards yet. There weren't typical behaviors yet. But what NBC tried to do was replicate radio broadcasting and the rhythms of radio on television in the morning. For example, there would be certain segments like weather at the same times every morning so the viewers could expect it, could predict it the same way they could on radio. The network also tried to create this sense of a family very early on. In those days, most of the family was made up of white men. It wasn't a particularly diverse family. But it was a group of people who got along well, or at least pretended to, who you could expect to see at the same time every morning. And they were very early on creating this sense of companionship. You turn on the television in the morning, and there's your companion or your group of companions for the morning, every morning. Mm.
You mentioned in the book, morning TV is created mostly for women, managed by men. Even today, you talk about how it's still managed by men, but created mostly for women. So what's the target? What's that crucial demo, as you say?
It's women between the ages of 25 to 54. They prefer younger audiences because advertisers seem to prefer younger audiences as well. Advertisers are willing to pay more for those younger viewers, and especially for those younger female viewers. The reality is that about half, a little bit more than half, of the audiences for these shows are actually people ages 55 and older. Mm-hmm. But they do target those younger audiences.
Well, one of the stories, of course, that grounds the book is the story of, as I mentioned, Ann Curry at the Today Show. So let's talk about that. I mean, you begin with a man by the name of Jim Bell, who was, as you write, early on in the book, he was sure, positive, in January of 2012, that he had the answer to a problem that, as you say, had been whispering to friends about for months now. Talk about this problem and introduce us to Jim Bell.
The Today Show in 2011 seemed to be losing a bit of its steam, or mojo, or something there. They had been number one in the ratings for 16 years. That means they had been beating Good Morning America and every other show that was on television in the mornings consistently every single week since 1995. Excuse me, that'd be even more impressive.
Right.
This streak, this 16-year-long streak, there'd been nothing else like it in television history.
Right.
Nothing in late night could compare. Nothing in prime time could compare. The Today Show was making history every week as it continued to win in the ratings. But the ratings race was getting more challenging. Good Morning America on ABC was slowly catching up to the Today Show. There was talk at NBC about a slow fade happening in the ratings. And there was a very real fear that Good Morning America could eventually overtake the Today Show and start to claw away some of that advertising revenue that NBC is so used to earning from the Today Show every year. Jim Bell looked at the Today Show in early 2012 and concluded that the problem facing the show, the biggest threat to the show, the biggest reason why it could lose to GMA, was Ann Curry, was the co-host who had been promoted 6 months earlier against, with the consent of Jim Bell, but not the full enthusiasm of Jim Bell.
Right.
Anchors are usually promoted by the heads of the news divisions that run these shows and with the support of the chief executives of these companies. So that's how seriously this is taken. In this case, it was Steve Capus, who was the president of NBC News, the man responsible for all the news content from NBC. And his decision to promote Ann Curry was blessed by Steve Burke, who was the brand new chief executive of NBC Universal. That's the giant media company that owns every piece of NBC, from the theme parks to the cable channels like USA to the news division, NBC News. Jim Bell went along with this promotion. He accepted that Ann Curry had earned this promotion after being on the show for 15 years reading the news. But he wasn't all that thrilled about the promotion. Some people say that he was undermining her from her very first day on the job in June of 2011. Whether he was or not, it's clear that by January of 2012, he was actively plotting a way to remove her because he had concluded that she was the biggest problem facing the show.
Yeah. We'll get to Ann Curry, why she was perceived as a problem. Do you think he's right? Was it Ann Curry? If you were to distill
it down, I think
Ann
Curry was a symptom of a larger problem. Certainly, he had a lot of good reasons to think about removing her from the show. She didn't have that same star power as Katie Couric or Meredith Vieira had. She didn't have the same chemistry with Matt Lauer as Katie or Meredith did. Ann Curry was not the overarching problem. The overarching problem today had more to do with the fact that the show was getting stale. It was getting too comfortable in first place. Of course, that's something that happens.
Yeah.
Media companies across the country, as you get too happy in first place, you get too comfortable in first place, well, that's the time your competitor usually strikes.
Bell believed Curry was this cancer that was steadily killing the Today Show. I wanted to ask you this question of what it was about Ann Curry, because I think it's reflective of why some people work and some people really don't. You keep seeing the words, and you mention them in your book, you know, atrocious about Ann Curry's delivery or performance, hopeless or clueless. And you mentioned, for example, there's this clip of her mispronouncing Benjamin Netanyahu's name, and then there's this awkward introduction where she says, "Good morning, everybody. Good morning, good morning." And what was interesting about that is there were like 200,000 page views of this thing, which was I found interesting because it seemed like there was this such this perverse interest in watching Ann Curry fail on one hand, which again goes to this idea of it being cutthroat. Even the audience itself, it seems like. I mean, she had plenty of followers and plenty of fans. But then there was the other side as well.
She also had many detractors. And in effect, she was a polarizing personality, which can be good at certain times of day on television or certain channels. But in morning TV, polarizing is probably not the term you want to have associated with yourself.
Right.
And Curry was this zany person, this unpredictable person, someone who seemed to have so many emotions and to feel so much and to have so many questions and want to get them all out. She was someone who, at least in the minds of many viewers, who seemed more fake the more and more she tried to be sincere. That there were so many, I suppose, personality traits and character traits about her that made her a polarizing figure for the same reasons some viewers loved her, for being so emotional and so invested in her interviews. Other people rolled their eyes at her and said she was fake or insincere. it's hard to really even explain her because she is such, I guess, a polarizing sort of person.
One of your colleagues at the New York Times, Mike Hale, kind of got at it. I mean, exactly what it was about her. I mean, he described her difficulty with these abrupt shifts in tone. Right. He wrote this. He says, as you watch the show, there's an inescapable sense that Curry is outside the group in a subtle but unmistakable way, like the stepsister Cinderella without a prince. She just didn't seem to fit in with the, I guess, that idea, the family, right?
Which is, by the way, okay. There are good reasons to have someone like that on a show like the Today Show. When I say she was unpredictable, I could view that as a great thing. It could bring some badly needed spontaneity to the show.
Yeah.
You never know what's going to happen next if Ann Curry's there. On the other hand, unpredictability can be very uncomfortable at 7 or 8 in the morning. When you turn on television at that hour, you want it to be predictable. You want it to be consistent from one day to another. Mm. And she didn't necessarily have that ability.
You write about how in morning TV, some producers anyway, say, look, you've got two types of hosts. You've got the actor and you've got the reactor. And you've got to have both of those elements to make this thing work. I mean, Matt Lauer and Katie Couric got along famously. I mean, they were the ones at the helm of the show for most of the streak, of course.
Right.
But Ann Curry wasn't fitting into that dynamic. I mean, I guess what I'm getting at, what is the gift? Do you think do you understand it, Brian Stelter? How does those who do it well, what have they got? What are they doing well?
They're able to predict what their partners are thinking and doing and saying and feeling, and they're able to respond in ways that are comfortable. There was an example at some point in the book from ABC, from the president of ABC News, talking about morning TV as a game of hacky sack. And that you have to be able to predict what your other players are going to do. You have to be able to pick up the hacky sack and keep it off the ground, keep the game going, keep the playing going. And it takes co-hosts who are comfortable with each other to be able to do that. This ABC News president, Ben Sherwood, said that he liked the news anchor for GMA, Josh Elliott, whom he poached from ESPN, because Josh had a background in improv in college. He was able to perform improv well. And that's something that is helpful for morning TV, to be able to react in a comfortable way to your co-host, to know where they're going and to be able to pick up where they left off. And to do that in a way that makes it look easy is actually very hard. And it's that's one of the traits that seems really valued in morning TV. Mm.
You write about, Bell basically concocts becomes Operation Bambi is the name of the thing. And basically, essentially, it's, I think this is how you put it, the reverse seduction of Ann Curry. Describe the plan.
This came about in early 2012. As I mentioned, Jim Bell decided that this was the biggest problem he had to tackle at the Today Show. He came up with what we can think of as a three-part plan. The first part was to renew Matt Lauer's contract, because Matt Lauer was thinking about leaving the Today Show at that time. He had been paired with Ann Curry for about 6 months. He had made it pretty clear how unhappy he was working with her. It wasn't that he was insisting on having her removed, but he wasn't thrilled to be sitting next to her. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Renewing his contract was important because once they had a commitment that that he was going to stay at the show, then they could remove Ann Curry. Then and only then. Because after all, if Matt Lauer had decided last year to leave the Today Show, well, they would have had to keep Ann Curry around, because Ann Curry was consistency, for lack of a better word. Even though she could be inconsistent on the air,
yeah,
you couldn't lose both Matt and Ann. You couldn't lose both co-hosts within a year or two. So first part, renew Matt Lauer. Get that deal done. And the second part would be removing Ann Curry from her job, giving her a job that would appear to be a promotion. And then the third part would be replacing her with Savannah Guthrie. That's the easiest part of this because, well, who can say no to the Today Show co-host job?
Yeah.
There was that three-part plan, but it was jokingly called Operation Bambi in the halls of NBC because a person said to Jim Bell at one point, wouldn't replacing Ann Curry be like killing Bambi? removing her would be like killing Bambi. The notion being that she is rather seems rather innocent as a character on the show and has a lot of fans out there. And that comment, that joke became this this catchphrase, Operation Bambi.
You spend some time with the kind of the dramatic events that lead up to Curry's dismissal. I mean, rumors and leaks and everything sort of comes to a head on Wednesday, June 20th. The secret is basically out. And you describe that day awkward, really, I guess. I mean, at first, Ann Curry decides she's not going to come into work. She's going to call in sick. But then she changes her mind, and she shows up. And I don't know, I wonder if you would talk about that. It was awkward. It was chilly. Brutal is the word that kept coming to my mind.
The last week that she anchored was brutal. Some people blame me for this, and I guess I should explain why.
Yeah.
I had heard in May that NBC was thinking about removing her from the show. At the time, I was working on this book, and I was also at my day job as a reporter at the New York Times. And honestly, I didn't believe it at first. I didn't think it was true. I didn't think it could possibly be true. But by June, it seemed to be becoming more real. I began to believe the rumors. And most importantly, I heard that Ann Curry had hired a lawyer to negotiate the terms of this change. And to me, that made it very real, and that made it newsworthy. I could no longer ignore the rumors. I certainly couldn't avoid writing about them. I felt that if I didn't write about them in the New York Times, well, one of my competitors would quite shortly. So I published a story on June 20th that said that Ann was in negotiations to leave the Today Show for another job at NBC. That story was the first time that this had been pushed into public view.
Right.
And the result was rather traumatic for Ann Curry, according to her friends and her colleagues. She's later blamed that story for taking away the possibility of her leaving the show gracefully, the suggestion being that if this had been kept a secret, then maybe she could have kept her composure and not been as upset as she was on the show 8 days later when she did sign off the air.
Yeah.
I personally don't believe that. I guess it's convenient for me to say that. For one thing, I don't think that it ever would have been kept a secret. And for another thing, I don't think she was ever going to be able to hold back her emotions. They were taking away her dream job. She had dreamed of it for 15 years. She had been finally given it a year earlier. And then these bosses were taking it away from her, which was a pretty traumatic thing for her. But it was that story on June 20th that I think worsened the attention in the studio. I write in the book about how Ann Curry and Matt Lauer didn't really speak to each other unless they were spoken to on the air, unless the cameras were rolling. They weren't speaking to each other because they had basically reached the end of their television marriage. The divorce papers were being drawn up by the lawyers, and nobody really wanted to speak at that point.
Mm. You know, the effect on Matt Lauer is, I guess we're still sort of telling what the effect is going to be on Matt Lauer. There's this,
right.
There's this tangential story you tell in the book early on about Arthur Godfrey, which I think is telling in some way, because you have these people like Matt Lauer, like Arthur Godfrey, who have a kind of persona, folksy, and their Q rating is really high. This is, you know, the way the public sees them and loves them. But it seems really fragile. And there's the story you tell. Again, you don't spend a lot of time with it, but I was really interested in Arthur Godfrey. This is 1953, and he, on the air, fires a member of his staff, this beloved singer. I can't even remember his name offhand right now, but that kind of marked the end in some way of Arthur Godfrey's popularity. His career sort of went downhill from there because he wasn't seen as folksy or charming anymore. And the same thing seems to be happening on some levels to Matt Lauer. He's being blamed for being mean to Ann Curry. Say something about that, if you would.
The video of Arthur Godfrey is still on YouTube today. Now, well, not still. It wasn't there for a long time.
Yeah.
YouTube wasn't invented. But nowadays, you can go back and watch it on YouTube. And I think that partially made the bad NBC situation worse last year. The video of Ann Curry's painful sign-off from a year ago is on YouTube, still Googleable, still viewable today. And it's as if it continues to to hurt the show further and further. It's something that continues to do damage. I think that's because NBC never fully explained why they did what they did. The way I see it, just as a viewer, NBC did the right thing by moving Anchorage off the show. The replacement, Savannah Guthrie, is a better host by many measures. Ann Curry is better as a correspondent than she was as a host. But they did it the wrong way. And by doing it the wrong way and not explaining what they were thinking, what they were doing, they've kept it going in the press and in the public's mind in a way that's been very damaging to the show and has been damaging in particular to Matt Lauer. Matt Lauer had a wonderful reputation for many good reasons. He's probably the best male morning host in history. He's been doing it longer than pretty much anybody else in history. He seems like as if he was, I quote the head of NBC News saying this in the book, it's as if he was born to do a job like the Today Show.
Yeah.
But the removal of Ann Curry, with Matt sitting next to her, watching her cry on the couch, unable to do much to make her feel better, it seemed to upset millions of viewers, some of whom already liked him and some of whom were already predisposed not to like him.
Right.
They took that as one reason not to like him. They blamed him for her tears. Fairly or not, they blamed him. NBC didn't give them anybody else to blame. NBC didn't explain what really happened. They didn't name the bosses who really made the decisions. And as a result, Matt took even more of the blame. And then I think there were other reasons that viewers latched onto if they already were predisposed not to like Matt Lauer. One is his contract. He makes far more money than any other morning show host. And he's earned it because it's the most lucrative show and he's the most important anchor there. But by some reports, he makes about $25 million a year. That contract, that price tag, was used as another reason to dislike him. And then rumors about his personal life, which have come up for years, which have never really been proven, but which have appeared in tabloids, were dredged back up again on the web. These weren't new rumors. They were old rumors. But the Ann Curry story gave them new life.
Yeah.
Gave them another reason for tabloids to print them. And I think what we saw was an instance where there was a door opened. There was one reason to be critical of someone, in this case, Matt Lauer. And then other reasons all cropped up. You know, we see it in sports all the time. We see athletes get blamed for one thing or get criticized for one thing. And then every other complaint ever lodged against them gets dredged back up, you know.
Mm. Brian Stelter is with us. His book is called Top of the Morning, Inside the Cutthroat World of Morning TV. And we'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. On the surface, the morning network TV shows, you see smiles and perkiness, but behind the sets, there is this cutthroat competition for the best guests, the most viewers, not to mention the hundreds of millions of dollars in ad revenue. The New York Times media reporter Brian Stelter went backstage at the morning shows to capture the reality for his first book. It's an inside look at this media phenomenon. It's called Top of the Morning, Inside the Cutthroat World of Morning TV. And Brian Stelter is joining us from the offices of the New York Times. So I wanted to ask you, Brian, about the I love the part about Good Morning America. And you write about how in 1975, ABC has been getting killed. And for years, they'd been getting killed by NBC, by the Today Show. And at first, it was interesting you say the show, the morning shows that the ABC was producing just kind of got by on the leftovers of the Today Show. They were sort of satisfied with that in those early days, which is interesting because one of the stories you tell is that a lot of the producers of the ABC stuff in the morning would just watch the Today Show and then do a version of that the next day.
I suppose they figured people weren't switching channels. So if you were loyal to ABC, you wouldn't know what NBC would have done. But there was a pledge made when Good Morning America was birthed in 1975. They would not have any guest on that had been on the Today Show the day before, which is a rule that's still in effect today. For the promotion of my book, I don't know if NBC would have ever let me on, but they certainly weren't going to once I went on Good Morning America last week. Even CBS, which is a distant third place in the ratings, was initially unwilling to have me on, although they did change their mind and bring me on the next day. that rule has been really important because it has, in some ways, made the shows more distinct. You know, it's made the shows both more competitive, but also made them less likely to be copycats of the other, which is a good thing for viewers.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting how the Good Morning America in 1975, I mean, they had lots of options to choose for between hosts. You mentioned between 115, 200 different options, and all the network guys were sort of figuring, you know, who would be good, you know, and they were thinking in a lot of ways about, you know, like game show hosts, you know, handsome and smiley. But they end up picking David Hartman, who you describe as the most unwink Martindale-ish name on the list. And it turns out to be a kind of brilliant choice and historically significant, you say.
Significant for a couple of reasons. One reason, he was an actor. He wasn't a newsman by trade.
Yeah.
And this morning show was produced by the Entertainment Division, while the Today Show was produced by the News Division. Those differences have blurred over the years, and Good Morning America is now produced by the News Division, even though it has quite a bit of entertainment in it. But back at the time, that was a big deal to have an actor hosting the show.
More conversational, the show, less formal. So it
and even
it
had, set in a fake home.
Yeah.
You know, it looked more like a living room or a kitchen. It was moving us more in a direction of informational programming as opposed to straight news programming.
And Hartman may not have had the chops as a journalist you talk about, but he was asking questions in conversational ways that may have made the news guys kind of wince, but this turned out to be really popular, and it seemed to be a kind of a huge hit. It really worked.
And as one of the original producers of GMA pointed out to me, once he started getting noticed for asking the questions viewers wanted to hear, then all the other newsmen on the other channels started doing the same thing. Rather than trying to sound like the smartest guys in the room, they tried more and more to sound like the ones most in touch with the viewers at home.
I wonder about this question you kind of deal with a bit, this balance of content, you know, the idea of the tabloid stuff versus the real news. And going back a little bit to NBC, Steve Kappas has this town hall style event in the Today Show workspace. And you write about how he had talked about he wanted to change the content of the Today Show. You know, he's talked about fewer stories from TMZ, more stuff from NBC's own reporters. He wanted to cut back on the sensationalistic crime stuff. And he mentions, you know, we used to be the New York Times. Now we're sort of seen as the Daily Mail. And then he says this. He says, I don't care if we're number two if we don't give up our principles. And I wondered if you thought he really meant that and how it is that the network executives really do balance the content to see what's going to stick.
I think he wanted to mean it.
Right.
I don't know if he entirely did. And I don't know if the producers entirely took him seriously. This battle over the mix of programming is really the eternal battle of morning TV.
Yeah.
It's been there for decades. Everybody agrees there should be some news and some entertainment. And to get that balance, to figure out where is the mix of those, that is always where the battles happen. Matt Lauer and Ann Curry last year, and now still this year, Matt Lauer and Savannah Guthrie, are almost always arguing in favor of more serious stories, more hard news. Or at least more programming that they feel is educating and informing the audience. The producers tend to be on the side of softer programming, more entertaining programming, more sensational stories, because they're the ones that feel the pressure more directly of the ratings. They see the overnight ratings, and they feel their jobs are more at risk than the anchors' jobs are if they don't deliver the ratings that they're supposed to.
Yeah.
And when Good Morning America was creeping up on the Today Show, before it started actually winning, Today felt tremendous pressure to be softer, to be more sensational. And you could see that play out on the air every day. And I actually think some viewers probably switched channels because of it. Now, some of them might have switched to GMA and just gone all the way in that direction of more sensational news. Others may have switched to CBS, which has a more serious approach in the mornings. And still others may have just turned off the TV altogether, because you can get so much information these days on the internet when you wake up, or frankly, through radio.
So what do you think it is that you've learned about what it is that people want in the morning? You know, what are they looking for? Do you think it's a mix of those kinds of elements, or do you have any sense of it after having reported this book?
I think they are looking for that mix. I think it's great that the shows now are so different, that CBS is more serious and that ABC is much more entertainment oriented, and that NBC is sort of in the middle of those two, giving you a mix of all of it. It's true at night as well. I wrote a story for The Times last year. I think it was last year. It was a while ago, about how the three network evening newscasts have differentiated themselves, CBS being the hardest, ABC being the softest in some ways. Softest is not a fair word. Let's call it more humanist interest-oriented, ABC being more human interest,
right,
and NBC in the middle. And NBC, in that case, kind of like the Goldilocks of television. It's true in the mornings as well. And I think it's good that there are some pretty clear choices in the morning. So I, for instance, might gravitate more towards CBS, but my girlfriend might gravitate more toward ABC. And it's good that we can have clear choices in the morning. Of course, cable gives us even more choices. Morning Joe and Fox and Friends and, mm-hmm, and hell, even the NFL Network has a four-hour NFL show in the morning. There are so many options now for people to choose from. The one downside of that is that it contributes to the sense that we don't all hear the same information and thus don't all argue from the same set of facts. But that's something that's equally true on cable and in the evenings as it is in the mornings.
So the changing dynamic of the digital age, the information age, what is that going to mean, do you think, for programs like The Today Show, like Good Morning America? Right now it's still in play. Sounds like, for sure. These are still...
It may make them more about the chemistry of the hosts.
Yeah.
Because if you wake up in the morning, you roll over in bed and you pick up your phone and you see what the headlines are, then you may not need morning TV to tell you those same headlines. What you may turn on morning TV for is the chemistry between the anchors, giving you companionship in the morning, some jokes to laugh at, some information to carry with you to work that morning, but not the headlines that you're getting on your phones. If I were Starbucks, for example, I would think about doing a morning show of my own. After all, they already have apps on people's phones, and they have a website, and they have screens in their stores. I think we're going to see more and more competitors like that that aren't traditional television networks, but which want to get a little bit of people's audience and attention spans in the mornings.
This idea of chemistry is, I think, really revealing. It's one of the things you write about. And you write about this meeting in the late 1970s. Fred Silverman of ABC, in the days, I guess, when they used to go to lunch with the competitor. You know, Fred Silverman is going to lunch with Paul Friedman. Paul's with the Today Show. Fred's with ABC. And you say that the question on Silverman's mind was this: what is it that influences viewers' choices more? Is it the content of the shows, or is it the chemistry of the co-hosts? So where it sounds like you've come down on the idea that content matters. It's probably a mix of that, but it seems to say something about the human nature of the audience that we want to see our hosts have a kind of chemistry.
I think it says that people like to watch people. For the same reason that people like to listen to people, right?
Yeah.
That's what we expect in the mornings. Content matters, but to me, at least, chemistry matters more. It's something that doesn't matter so much when it's there, but it matters more when it's not there. And that's what we saw with Ann Curry and Matt Lauer. We don't notice chemistry necessarily until it's missing.
Yeah. I want to ask about, you sort of referred to this, but CBS This Morning, for example, was envisioned as a kind of brand new kind of morning program, you know, not as much pop culture stuff and cooking segments and concerts. I mean, this is Charlie Rose, and it's going to return to news, is how they put it, you know, put more of a premium on public policy and politics, those kinds of things. How is that working, do you think? And what is that telling us about whether or not news is going to play that well in the morning?
I sure hope CBS can be part of a sequel that I can write someday, because I barely mentioned them in this book for the following reason. When CBS This Morning launched in January of 2012 with Charlie Rose and Gayle King, originally with Erica Hill as the third host, now with Nora O'Donnell as the third host. I thought it would be a big deal. I thought it would draw either a lot of new viewers or lose a lot of current viewers. I thought in either direction there would be significant changes, but really there weren't. The show just continued on with about the same number of viewers it had before it relaunched with a more hard news look and feel. It just kind of existed with 2.5 million viewers every day, about half as many as Good Morning America and The Today Show. But something happened in January of this year. Just as I was finishing the book, CBS This Morning started to really gain in the overnight ratings. It showed a slow but steady progress with viewers. It's now up above 3 million viewers some weeks, still a ways away from the other two. But it makes me wonder if viewers are starting to find this new show and like this new show. If CBS has patience, which is something they historically have not had in the morning, but if they have patience this time, maybe they can draw a bigger and bigger audience for this show. It's something that it's going to be very interesting to watch in the years to come, because they may very well be able to prove that the viewers, some viewers, do want serious, significant, hard news in the mornings.
I guess part of that question, though, is maybe is part of it that it's just the shiny new thing.
That's a good point. That could be part of it, that people are sampling it to see if they like it or not, giving it a tryout. And, of course, there are lots of other shows on cable that are serious as well, Morning Joe being the most talked about one. So it's possible that people are just giving CBS a try. But, simply for good storytelling reasons, I would like for that show to gather an audience, because it creates even more competition among the networks. And that's a good thing for viewers as well as for reporters like me.
Brian Stelter, he's a media reporter for The New York Times. His new book is called Top of the Morning, Inside the Cutthroat World of Morning TV. He joined us from a studio there in the offices of The New York Times. Brian, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, technical direction from Mike Anderson, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.